Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraic Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Hi, good evening. Welcome to the first Little Atoms of 2010. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with Rebecca Watson. And before we actually get into the show properly, our last show before Christmas, our Nine Lessons and Carols special, has caused something of a complaint. So basically, Rebecca's going to talk about this first of all.
That's right. Thank you, Neil. We do take these things very seriously because here in Little Atoms we do try to strive for journalistic integrity and scientific integrity as well. So we take email responses very seriously. So after our last show, this email came to us from Jim. Jim writes, "The interview about the LHC was unfortunately what one would expect from a high school student trying to get by without research. Circulating kittens is not possible. Since you have to use charged particles, it's all magnetic steering and acceleration. It is a very uninformed and dumb question." Of course, Jim was referring there to our interview with Brian Cox, in which we discussed the Large Hadron Collider and whether or not one could stick two kittens inside the collider and what would then happen. So we didn't realize at the time that it's not, in fact, possible to accelerate two kittens to the appropriate speed. And for that reason, we'd like to apologize and also to correct the record by having Professor Brian Cox on the show today to discuss the LHC, any plans or research he might have done on a large kitten collider, and any other science that he's currently working on. So welcome to the show, Professor Brian Cox.
Thank you. I think Jim's been a bit pedantic there, because you can charge a kitten by rubbing it on your jeans. You know, it's not too difficult to charge a kitten. The problem with a kitten is that they're quite massive. There are too many protons in. So I think he's focused on the wrong thing.
Right.
You can charge a kitten up to really very high potential, actually, by connecting it to a plug socket, if it's appropriately earthed. And, you know, it'd be fine.
Have you actually done any hands-on experiments with that sort of thing?
I wouldn't put my hands on the damn thing if it was charged up to a million volts. I'd leave it to prickle. But I thought you said we were going to talk about serious science here.
Oh, let's
talk
are.
About, yeah, yeah, after that we've got over the, yeah.
We have some other questions.
He's focusing on the wrong thing. Okay. It's the mass of the kitten that I objected to, if you remember.
That's true.
Rather than the neutral nature of it.
Well, thank you for putting the record straight, Brian.
So, okay, so now we can move on to the first Little Atoms of 2010. And I will introduce Brian properly for anybody who, one or two listeners who might not be aware who he is. Professor Brian Cox is a particle physicist, a Royal Society Research Fellow, and a professor at the University of Manchester. He is a member of the High Energy Physics Group at the University of Manchester and works on the ATLAS experiment at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. He is best known to the public as the presenter of numerous science programmes for the BBC, including the upcoming Seven Wonders of the Solar System, and he recently co-authored a book called Why Does E Equal MC Squared?
Which has a cat on the front. Actually, Jim,
charge cat.
You're listening. Yeah. You can't tell whether it's charged or neutral.
So let's talk about, Brian, let's talk about the LHC in proper science terms. So what does it do?
It accelerates protons around, it's 27 kilometres in circumference. So it's about, 100 metres below the surface of Geneva. And we accelerate protons to 99.999999% the speed of light. And
they go around. Is that accurate?
It's pretty accurate, actually, yeah. That's about the right number of nines. And I think there might be a one at the end of that. Jim will correct us if it's right. It is 99.999999% the speed of light. So they go around the ring 11,000 times a second at that speed, when it's running at full energy. And then we collide them together.
11,000 times a second.
11,000 times a second around the 27 kilometres. Which looks like, actually, because of relativistic effects, something like, I think it's about 3 metres to the protons. So it gets, there's this wonderful effect called a Lorentz contraction, which means that if you're travelling very close to the speed of light relative to something else, mm-hmm. then that's something. So if you're the proton, then it looks like the ring's flying around very fast close to the speed of light. So it shrinks. And so it looks like something, I think it's about 3 metres to the protons. So slightly off subject, but interesting bit of relativity.
Should get one of these protons on the show to
the
talk
other thing
about
is
their experience.
Time passes 7,000 times more slowly for them than it does for the people sitting there. So it's ultra-relativistic. And we do that so we can collide them together and recreate the conditions that were present less than a billionth of a second after the universe began. And we can do that many times a second, up to 600 million times a second, actually. So you can just keep pulling these numbers out of a hat. It's an astonishing achievement. The reason we do it is that we found that through experiment over the last century or so, that the further back in time you look to the Big Bang, so in a sense, I suppose, the higher the energy or the higher the temperature you go to look at the universe, the simpler it appears. And so if you really want to understand not only the building blocks of the universe, the particles that make it up, but the forces that stick it together, then this is the best way of doing it. So it's really mainline physics, understanding how the forces of nature work, how the universe evolved by experiment, by actually doing it, recreating these. It'd be wrong to say Big Bangs. It's kind of a PR thing to say, but recreating these conditions as often as you can and making precision measurements of them.
What do you expect to find? What sort of results are you hoping to get?
Well, we know, because you can't just build one of these things because they cost $6 billion or something like that. So you can't just build it for a laugh and say, hope we see something. You know, we know where our current picture of the laws of nature breaks down. And it's at a particular energy, which is, you could say, 1.4 TeV. So an electron volt is the amount of energy an electron gets if you accelerate it through a potential difference of 1 volt. So you get a 9-volt battery, you can make an electron go to 9 electron volts. Well, at an energy of about 1.4 million million electron volts, we know that something happened in the universe. So that's like a temperature, a very high temperature. And what happened was that mass got generated and made its appearance in the universe. So there's some mechanism that we think happened in the early universe that gave the particles that make up you and me mass and left some particles, like photons, particles of light, massless. So they travel through the universe at the speed of light. So it's a fundamental occurrence in the early universe. And we know where to look for that phenomena because we've, through experiments over the last, let's say, 50 years, we've seen where that interesting, profound thing occurs, but we don't know what did it. That one theory is that there's a thing called the Higgs particle that many people have heard of, this thing called gets called the God particle sometimes if you want to sell a book with it on the front and let the people buy it who don't like creationists or something, or like creationists.
Kittens on covers sell
better. Yeah, it's that kind of stuff. But it's the Higgs theory is a theory for the origin of mass in the universe. But whatever nature has chosen to do that, we know where to look, and the LHC goes there. So without doubt, you see that process in action, whatever it may be. And it may be the Higgs, or it may be something we haven't thought of.
What's the timeline?
Well, particle physics is essentially quantum mechanics. So you bang things together, and a different thing happens every time. So the job of the LHC is to bang protons together a lot. And, you know, one in every, I don't know what number is, let's say 10 billion, probably more, probably 1,000 billion, a trillion collisions, something interesting might happen, right? Like you might produce a Higgs particle, so you could see it. So basically, the particle physics is the job of colliding as many protons together as you can, billions and billions and billions of them, accumulating the data over months and years, and then sifting through it for something interesting. So if I was to guess in an unscientific way, if the LHC works well, you might say within 2 or 3 years, you might should have some hints of that process. But the one thing that's worth saying is that every particle accelerator that we've built, and I've worked on three now, have become famous for discovering something unexpected. So whilst you build the LHC, you know that the origin of mass in the universe is there. There are other things that might be sitting there, like dark matter. We know that the universe is full of stuff that we don't understand because we can see the way that galaxies move around and interact with each other. That's probably a new form of particle, we think, that's not been detected yet. We might make those things and see them. We might discover extra dimensions in the universe and get some signposts to questions like, why is gravity such a weak force of nature? You know, there's a huge amount of physics that we don't understand. And these machines are the way to give you a chance of answering those questions. So there's some definite things and some wonderful things that might happen that you never know.
Let's just go back to, you mentioned dark matter, and we were talking before about the idea of the Higgs particle being possibly what gives mass to other particles, and dark matter is this famous sort of hypothetical thing, or although it looks like somebody might have found some. But
there's a signature for this dark matter, yeah, in an American experiment. It's not... You know, it's one or two events, and it wouldn't tell you what it was. It would just... The idea is that if it exists, then there's more of it than there is the stuff that makes up the stars and planets we can see. And we would be drifting through it now. So in the room you are sat in, there's dark matter particles flying around, very heavy, but they interact very rarely with matter, probably via something called the weak force. They have to interact somehow, or they'd be completely decoupled. So there's gravity... And also possibly this weak force, which is the way that, if you've heard of things called neutrinos that come streaming out of the sun, something like 60 billion per centimetre squared per second passing through the Earth from the sun, and you don't feel them. They go straight through the Earth, straight through you most of the time. But if they go very close to an atom, a nucleus in your body, let's say, then they'll interact. And so occasionally, maybe once a week, one of these neutrinos will bump into something in your head, you know, because there's so many of them. It's the same with dark matter particles. So these experiments basically look for them just bumping into the detector because they're all over the place. And there's a possibility that that signature may have been seen, but it's
early days.
Rare, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So this, again, you just mentioned the idea of the LHC perhaps possibly also helping in the search for dark matter as well.
Yeah, because there's a theory called supersymmetry, which is a mathematical theory which is very... It's mainstream and it's quite beautiful mathematically, and it makes specific predictions that you can test. And one of the predictions is that there's the prediction is that there's a whole mirror world, essentially. So for an electron, there's a particle called the selectron, supersymmetric electron. And for a quark, there's a squark. And for the Higgs, there's a Higgsino. And for the W's and Z's, there are Wienos and Zenos. And there's Photinos, all the things. So it doubles the number of particles, basically. But it does that for kind of aesthetic reasons. But it does some nice things, like... For one thing, it makes the three of the four forces of nature, when you calculate their strengths and how they vary as you turn back time towards the Big Bang, what you find is that the strong nuclear force, which is one of them, and the weak nuclear force, which is another one, and electromagnetism, which is the third one, kind of converge together. And already we've seen the weak force and electromagnetism converge into one force, mm-hmm. right? So they're the same thing. So in our theory of the universe at the moment, they're one force, and that works. But the strong force seems to almost do it as well. But in our standard picture, without supersymmetry, it just doesn't quite work. But with supersymmetry, it works. And so you get this beautiful picture of these three of the four forces of nature becoming one as you go back to the Big Bang. So it's quite tempting.
That's but going backwards. What would explain how they split?
Well, so the picture is as the universe expanded and cooled, then you get these things called symmetry breaking happening. So basically, complexity kind of crystallizes out. An analogy is like a magnet, actually. If you heat a magnet up, a bar magnet, then it loses its north and south poles. You don't have them anymore. And if you let it cool down, then you get this spontaneous lining up of all the little molecules, and you get the magnetism back. But it's a random direction. The north and south poles won't be the same direction necessarily, but they'll be there. And so it's a spontaneous emergence of order. And in that way, the universe seems to behave like that, certainly with the forces of nature. So the idea is there's one force and the universe cools and they crystallise out into three different forces, and that's what we see today. So supersymmetry unifies three of the four forces, but it also provides a candidate for a particle that looks for all the world like a dark matter particle. So it's almost there, it's a prediction almost of the theory that there should be dark matter particles. Not quite, but nearly. So if you see any of these supersymmetric particles at LHC, then you have a very strong candidate for understanding what dark matter is. And really the nature of it, not only that it exists, but what it is. It's right. One of these things.
And the idea of breaking supersymmetry, that was what just won someone a Nobel Prize, is that right? Most recent...
did it? Yeah, you might be right. I'm not sure. It may have done. It may have passed me by.
I think it did. And I was going to ask, I mean, is there a Nobel Prize in your future, then?
No, I mean, I would say that no, not me personally, but there will be, I suspect, Nobel Prizes won by the LHC and by the experimental collaborations, and I'm part of one of them. But there are, you know, 2,000 physicists on my collaboration called ATLAS, which is one of the detectors that looks at the collisions. So, you know, actually, the question of who gets a Nobel Prize for great discoveries in these big experimental collaborations is interesting. It may give them... to the collaboration, maybe. It's not really clear. So I would expect the thing I work on at LHC, someone will get a Nobel Prize for the work the LHC does.
But you might have to fight someone to actually put it on your coffee
table. But it wouldn't be me. If they were going to give it to someone, they wouldn't give it to me. They'd give it to... There's a guy called Lynn Evans, who's a British physicist, who could be described as the father of the machine, the LHC. I mean, he ran the whole project. So you might think... there's a British Nobel Prize coming to... He's Welsh, actually. So a Welsh Nobel Prize. I don't know how many of those there are. I don't even want to go there with what you... But that would be a natural Nobel Prize. Peter Higgs may get one. He's British. So it would be a great British success story, actually.
He already has a particle named after him.
Well, yeah, but... we don't know it exists, though. He might have been right.
Theoretical part.
If he's right,
yeah,
and he's there in Edinburgh at the moment, he's still there watching. He postulated the existence of this thing in the 60s. So he's been waiting a long time.
Well, considering the huge British investment in the LHC and the tie-in with so many British scientists, do you think that will help the British community and the British government even look at funding this sort of thing in a more powerful way?
One would hope so. I mean, what time is it? It's 7:15.
Well, you have just taken us
into the
second half of the show, Rebecca, there by accidentally. So I'm just going to say, you're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and Rebecca Watson. We're talking to Brian Cox. And in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about science funding. So if Brian now can answer Rebecca's question.
Oh, is it the second half of the show?
It just started right now.
Not many ads, not many commercials in your show.
No, we'll add them later.
It's all product placement, so that's why we're all drinking
water.
Tap water. Yeah. We're not very good at it yet.
Science funding. We spend so little money on scientific research, researching nature, trying to understand the universe, that it's astonishing. I mean, I find it astonishing. It's something like 0.23% of GDP. Let's say. Now, you can argue about the figures, and so the government always wins. You go, it's 0.24. You know, but that's roughly how much gets spent on the research councils that give money to universities and pay for CERN and pay for the European Space Agency, pay for medical research, everything you can think of, nuclear fusion, nuclear power research, everything gets paid for from about 0.23% of GDP, let's say, which is about £3.5 billion a year, something like that. So it's a tiny amount of GDP. When you think that that's everything, that's understanding the universe and the way that our bodies work and the way that everything works, right? And you imagine where we've got with those levels of expenditure. By the way, Britain is below average. So to put it in context, we're a long way down the league table anyway. But not many countries spend much more. And yet we've built the modern world. Right, we understand medical science quite well. We can build satellites that go into space. We can have global positioning systems, iPhones, whatever you want. We've got it from a few people doing a bit of research because it's underfunded. So I, for the life of me, don't understand why a government, the next government, don't say, well, let's make Britain the best place in the world to do science. Right? What would be the impact of that on our country? It would be incalculable. Our universities would be... They're already pretty much the best in the world with the exception of the US, probably.
Yes.
We have four in the top 10, I think, something like that. So we're doing pretty well. But you imagine, I mean, and you, so let's say you went to 0.4% of GDP, right, rather than 0.23. We'd then be world leading. And it's something you could afford to do. It's a couple of billion, let's say. But then, so you might say, well, that's a lot of money. I mean, the government spends something like 600 billion a year, so it's a small amount of money. But then you look at the return. I mean, the a fascinating figure I found from the government said that 6.4% of UK GDP was physics-based, right, from physics-based industry. 6.4%. Right, that's the financial sector's about 8.5%. And yet we spent, what, £1 trillion? £800 billion bailing out the financial sector? That's more money than we spent on science since Jesus, right, in the UK, right? It's just, you could, the whole UK expenditure
wasn't even that big
on science.
Yeah, yeah, he wasn't that great a promoter of science funding.
Ever, really. Right, since ever in the UK is less than what we spent this year on bailing out the banks. Now, that may be a ridiculous thing to say. There'll be politicians listening, if they do listen, that will say, it's ridiculous because we had to bail. I don't care about the argument. It's just to set the scale of the amount of money we spend. And given what I think we all agree science gives to us, which is stops us living in caves, right? Everything has been given to us by that. I find it astonishing. Well, I don't know why we don't do that. Why Britain doesn't take a lead. And I mean, America's doing it. I mean, Obama just announced a, what, 7% increase, and the aim is to double science research funding through the NSF, the science research body, double it by, I think it's 2020. I think in a decade, they want to double it. Well, that's visionary, right? And it's because there's one or two sensible people in Obama's administration, deliberately, like the energy secretary, who's got a Nobel Prize in physics, whose name has just escaped me. But, you know, so there's one or two people. So it doesn't take much political will
to I'll just
do
point,
something wonderful, but we don't do it.
Right. I'll just point out that it's a bit odd, though, to say that America's been doing it, because they haven't until Obama, under Bush. I mean, that was one of the most anti-science administrations ever.
It was, but they still... but still the investment was there, but not... It wasn't increased, right? So it's just the ambition. So what Obama tells me is that if you get one person, the Prime Minister, let's say, so let's point the finger at Gordon Brown, who claims to be a fan of science, the President of the US in a recession can afford to make a pledge to double science spending in 10 years because obviously it's a sensible thing to do. So these are small amounts of money. These are £1 billion we're talking about, not two. Even in the US, you're talking about a few billion dollars, which is a tiny amount. For the return, I mean, probably, you know, I don't know what the number is for the amount of the British economy based on science. It's probably about a third, given that physics is 6.5% on its own. And then you put biotech in there and chemical engineering, aerospace, you know, I don't know how much it is, but it's a lot.
The amount spent, though, is just one of the facets of this, isn't it? Because I remember from the talk you did at TAM London back in October was kicked off with a sort of point that the government is almost changing the emphasis on funding and saying, you know, we want to fund things that basically will bring some sort of economic benefit.
Oh, there's that, which is grotesque idiocy at the level that you can't even believe that they're being, I mean, there's some sort of petition gone into Downing Street, and it's, I think there's something like 10 Nobel Prize winners, 50 fellows of the Royal Society, and everybody, right? Everybody who's got a brain and some accreditation that shows they've got a brain has written to them and said, that's nonsense. And they still do it. And I asked the science minister, actually, how many people does it take? How many Nobel laureates and professors and everybody do have to write to you saying this is idiocy before you actually scratch your head and say, no, actually, maybe you're right?
Well, I don't know. And speaking of what it's going to take, I mean, so do you think it's going to take a complete upheaval of administration? Do we just need to band together and vote these people out of office?
I think that we need to make science an election issue in even the tiniest way. I mean, I've spoken to politicians, actually, and in private they will say that science loses out. So we didn't win as much as we should have in the growth period of the economy. Now you can see that, you know, there are pressures on everybody. But the problem is we've been pressurised from a low base in the UK because we didn't lobby at all. We have not got a loud voice. So what people like us and the listeners of this programme and the sceptic movement in general, I think, can do is begin to be more politicised about the general issue of how scientific our society is, right? Because it's, I mean, it's not only research and development which feeds into the economy. Everybody knows it does. But it's also scientific literacy. It's education. It's inspiring kids to go into science. They don't do it because of some government initiative. They do it because of things like the LHC. Right? So you do wonderful things. You go to the moon. You go to Mars. You find life on Mars. Right? Suddenly the imagination is captured and people do things and are inspired and society grows. And you know, there's an argument. I mean, everyone accepts it if you say the London Olympics in 2012 is going to, the economy will grow because of the inspirational factor of the Olympics. What if Britain decided to go to Mars, right? What was the inspirational factor? And I can tell you, there's a study done on Apollo, the economic return on Apollo, in 1975 by Chase Economics. And they found that for every dollar spent on going to the moon, $14 came back into the US economy. And that came back because of the inspiration. A lot of it came back from the number of extra engineers and the number of extra scientists and economy kids who got inspired by the Apollo program. It grows the economy. So it's obvious, but we don't bother. You know, we have a little government initiative to say, let's do this in schools. And don't do it in schools. Build the LHC, right? And then kids get interested because it's interesting.
Yeah, and just very briefly, speaking of going into space, what about ditching government and focusing on private industry? Look at what Virgin's doing, Virgin Galactic.
You can do that. I mean, one way that we're trying to get some more money back into British science is to encourage industry to invest in a philanthropic way. I mean, it happens more in the States than it does in Britain. And that's complicated, the reasons for that, the tax system and things. But you can do that. But I think the thing is that science is a long-term investment and it's for the public good. And it really is blue sky science, R&D, in that scale, the LHC looking. That stuff that doesn't have an immediate economic return and therefore it's sensible for the public to fund. Stuff that has an economic return, you might say, well, we'll leave that to industry because it has an economic return. So it's doubly idiotic what the government are trying to do.
Well, we're going to quickly, in the last couple of minutes, I was going to talk about Brian's upcoming series, Seven Wonders of the Solar System, but I just have to say, look out for that.
Be on in March.
Yeah, it's on in March. Brilliant. But before we finish, Rebecca this afternoon has invented a new feature for the show, so I think we should give this a test outing.
Yeah, I asked people on Twitter if they had any questions for Brian, and so a lot of people sent me in questions, and I thought one was particularly great, submitted by Kate Swebb is her Twitter name, and she said that so much has been accomplished in physics in the past 100 years. Where do you think we're going to be 100 years from now in terms of physics?
I hope we will understand the origin of mass in the universe because the LHC will give us that. I hope we understand why gravity is such a weak force. There's something deep, definitely, about gravity. There's the fact that the universe is accelerating in its expansion. We don't know why that is. There's dark matter. We don't know what that is. So we don't know what 96% of the universe is, let's say. So there's definitely something very deep about our picture of the universe that we don't understand. And it feels a bit like 1900, I think, at the moment, the turn of the last century, when the wheels were coming off and quantum mechanics, relativity, all these beautiful things emerged. So I think something beautiful will emerge in the next 20 years, something really profound.
In the next 20 even?
I think so. I think we've got signs that we're beginning to know where to look, and there's a lot we don't understand, and that's the place where you want to be.
That's fantastic. Are we?
Yeah, that's about the end of it. And Brian, thanks very much for coming in and settling the kitten issue mainly.
Yeah, that's a huge thing.
I'm going to try it. I'm going to try it though. See, I'm going to prove him wrong by experiment.
True scientist.
We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.